In this Easter episode, we travel through life, death, and into eternity. This is Penhold Talk Radio. And welcome back to the show. Thank you for, again, joining us this week. My name is Brian Constein. I am here with my co-host, Michael Rowland.
Hello, hello.
And as we typically like to do, we want to start off with some news in Penhold here. And it was just posted this last week that there's going to be a celebration of life for Jim Pendergast. And if you're not familiar with that name, you probably just recently moved here.
Yeah, if you've lived here for long, you probably are familiar.
Yeah, he was a long-serving fire chief here in Penhold. I believe it was for 12 years. I want to say it's about 12 years, though it certainly seemed like a much bigger impact than just 12 years.
Yeah.
But he recently passed away due to an illness. And so they're planning a celebration of life for Jim for Saturday, May 7th at 2:00. And it's going to be taking place at the Penhold Memorial Center. I don't have any really other information than that. If you go to Jim Pendergast Facebook, and I'm guessing that's where I saw the post. I'm guessing the fire department web or Facebook will probably have something as well. And so it looks like they're going to have the celebration of life at the Penhold Memorial Hall on May 7th. So that's a Saturday at 2:00. And then it also says that there's going to be a last ride following the service. And so it looks like it should be a very nice send off and ceremony for our late fire chief.
Mm-hmm.
And that kind of gives us a segue into, as well, the kind of the larger theme that we're going to be looking at today. And this being Easter weekend, I thought this would fit in. We'll look at some issues and topics related to the idea of life and death, and a little bit of life after death, as Easter is typically known for.
Yep.
Easter hasn't been as secularized yet as Christmas has.
Yeah.
It's a little less easy to kind of market the whole dying on the cross thing. It's hard to get wrapped up in that, at least from a secular level. For Christians, like this, at least from my two cents, Easter should be what Christmas is.
Yeah, we make a big deal out of Christmas, but Easter is kind of the big climax of the story. That is what it's all about.
Oh yeah, like this is the victory. This is what we celebrate. This is what differentiates Christianity from all other religions, is the death and resurrection of Jesus Christ.
Yeah.
And it's only through his death and resurrection that salvation is received.
Yeah.
Certainly nothing that we've done. And so with that kind of in mind, with that whole life and death and more life after death idea, there's a couple stories worth kind of highlighting on that. And the first one, just want to kind of touch off on, is kind of a life well lived. I guess a couple examples. Let's put it that way. The first headline I want to bring to your attention is from CTV News out of Toronto. And the headline is 101-year-old Hazel McCallion accepts 3-year contract extension working for Toronto Pearson.
That is the most optimistic thing you'll hear all year.
Maybe.
101-year-old woman is committing to a 3-year term, still working for Pearson Airport in Toronto there.
Yeah, so the article says that Hazel McCallion, one of the longest serving mayors in Canadian history, has accepted a 3-year contract extension as a Greater Toronto Airport Authority board member. And then it says the Federal Transport Minister, Amar Agrabah, said in a news release that this week that the 101-year-old was reappointed to the GTAA board as a director. Then later on in the article, it says McCallion served as the mayor of Mississauga, where Toronto Pearson Airport is located, for 36 years.
Like, I've heard of people having a difficult time retiring, but my goodness, talk about commitment to your community and to your surrounding area.
Yeah,
she just is just dedicated.
hey, you know, is yeah, if age shouldn't. Okay, let's put it this way. Age is not a determining factor. If you can do the job, then do the job.
That's, absolutely.
I'm all about this whole merit-based work job application. Like, if you can do the job, then why do all these other externalities that have really no bearing on it factor in? There's too much of this. But if she can still do it at 101, then good for her.
No kidding.
Put a lot of people to shame probably for continuing on at 101 years old. And yeah, as you pointed out, not only is she still working at 101, but it's this optimistic, like, this isn't, we'll play it by year. I guess yes. Either one works. But like, yeah, she's not just signing up for, you know, I'll see how this next year plays out or this next year plays out. This is a 3-year contract, essentially.
Yeah.
And so as a 101-year-old, not only is she still active, she still has it would appear she has in writing a very optimistic outlook on life.
Yeah, there's nothing said in this article, but I would assume that she's in reasonably good health. Like, good for her.
Yeah.
That's impressive.
Yeah, I haven't looked into anything else beyond kind of this story, but just that that alone is remarkable that the board feels competent enough that she is still a worthwhile contributor at 101 years old.
Yeah, I guess that's a good point too. It's not just her optimism, but the board as well.
Yeah, yeah. There are some other world leaders that might question their mental acuity at a much younger age. I'll let our listeners fill in all the details they want into that. They can
read
project
into it.
That. Yeah, they can project that onto whichever person they want. All right. So the second article that caught my attention this week is another sanitarian, right? Is that, did I get it?
Sanitarian.
Sanitarian. We had to look this up.
Centenarian.
Centenarian.
There we go.
Centenarian. Yeah, there's so many just. Yeah, I wonder how many of our listeners knew. It's not centurion. That's some Roman guy.
Yep.
It's not centurion, I don't think.
Apparently, they throw an extra EN in there.
There's an extra syllable. So it's a centenarian.
Centenarian.
Centenarian. See, I can't even get in there. Centenarian. I'm looking at the word and I can't even say it. Maybe I shouldn't have put the word century right beside it. But here, the headline reads from the Daily Wire, "Woman who typed Schindler's List dies at 107. So that puts her birth date at 1915.
Yeah.
Depending on 1915, or it could be 1914, I think.
It says in the article here, 1915.
There you go, 1915. So I think that's right near the beginning of the First World War.
Yeah.
There's not a lot of people that have those kind of dates still.
Yeah, and to live to 107. I made a comment earlier that you live through these kind of things and nothing can take you out. You just live forever. Like, she lived to 107 years old.
Yeah, when I think about Holocaust survivors, to me, it feels like, good, you survived, but how much life did it just drain out of you? And yet there's just so many of these people who have gone through it feel like they're only stronger on the other side of it.
They come out with a greater appreciation for life.
A lot of them do. Yeah. I
definitely see that in a lot.
The headline or the story begins, during the reign of the Third Reich, Oskar Schindler, a German and member of the Nazi party, saved more than 1,000 Jews from being murdered in the Holocaust. Schindler's name has lived on through history as a hero, but the woman who helped compile the list of names that would eventually get more than 1,000 Jews out of the concentration camps is far less known. And her name is Mimi Reinhardt. And she was the secretary who typed up Schindler's List. And it says she died on Friday. So it would have been a week Friday when this airs in Israel at the age of 107. So it's been a while since I've actually seen Spielberg's take on this movie or on this story.
Yeah.
So I was kind of doing a little bit of review on this, just kind of get some background on what went on. And so Oskar Schindler himself, as it says, was German, and he became actually a member of, in 1936, He was a member of Nazi intelligence. And then in 1939, he became an actual member. And so by the time the World War II is in full swing, he's actually fairly high up in the echelon of Nazi authority.
Like pretty high ranking an SS officer, isn't he? Like
yes,
it's kind of one of the most kind of notorious, horrific, like looking back, horrific things to be.
Yes.
So, yeah.
And so in 1939, Oscar Schindler purchases and begins to run an enamelware factory out of Krakow, Poland. So I'm guessing some sort of, the only thing that comes to mind is like dishes. I didn't look into what an enamelware, but this is wartime. I would think there'd be something more military,
providing supplies for military use. It became a pretty crucial element to the military efforts. And so that's what helped him become very successful in it. It became crucial to keep the military push going, all the supplies he was able to produce.
Yeah. And then he eventually moved into more ammunition later on. But so he purchases, or he becomes this operator of a factory in Krakow, Poland in 1939. And this is where Mimi Reinhardt lived up until 1942, when it was overrun and she and the rest of the Jews in the area were moved first into a ghetto, a Jewish ghetto. And before she was then moved to a concentration camp, Plaszow, in Poland. It was also during this time that her husband was killed while they're in the ghetto. And so this happened in 1942. In the meantime, Oscar Schindler's factory is up and going. In fact, though, as things go on more and more, he's hiring Jews, and Jews are actually, I'm not sure how it all works out, whether they're kind of just forced to work in the factory or not. I wouldn't be surprised probably. But Reinhardt, when she was captured, she had the skill of knowing shorthand. So basically kind of way of being a secretary, you can take shorthand notes.
Yeah. Very efficient in writing.
Yeah. And so this allowed her to become a work in kind of the camp offices, the concentration camp offices. Like camp offices just sounds too polite.
Yeah.
And it was in that role that she became aware of and became known by Oscar Schindler. And eventually she became Oscar Schindler's secretary. And so by 1944, Schindler has a factory that employs over 1,700 people, and 1,000 of them are Jews. And it's over this time frame that he's run his factory that he's become more and more sympathetic toward the plight of the Jews. And it's over that 4-year span that he's kind of been able to, through bribery and purchasing favors, to bring in more and more Jews into the factory and basically saving them from concentration camps. Now the story continues that in 1944, as Allied forces are kind of pushing in on the Eastern Front, they have to move that factory. So they move it further in to an area now in kind of the Czechoslovak area, though I think it's Czech Republic, but they have to move the factory down. And so the list that's being referred to is the list of the workers that are going to be transferred from this factory in Krakow down to this new one in the Czech Republic. And so there's a list of about 1,200, and Mimi Reinhardt is one that kind of typed up this list. She herself was on it. Now, to heighten the kind of the to unnecessarily heighten the suspense of this, in 1944, I think it was in October, if I remember my notes, there's about 200 or so put onto a train that was meant to go from Krakow to this new place, to the new factory, but was diverted to Auschwitz.
Oh man.
And so so Mimi was on that train that was transferred to Auschwitz. Now, Fortunately, though, it stayed there for about 2 weeks before things got straightened out and was moved on to its proper destination.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. She's quoted, it says, describing that 2 weeks as straight out of Dante's Inferno. And if you haven't read Dante's Inferno, those are some of the most graphic images you can ever imagine. And described in his descent into hell is what that book is about. And so, yeah, it just, you know, like I said, to unnecessarily heighten the suspense, that's what happened to her. Fortunately, she did end up obviously surviving, Mimi Reinhart, and survived all the way until just last week.
Yeah.
A remarkable time in her life. Like I said, instrumental in facilitating the survival of 1,200 Jews. And then article continues on, you know, how she, you know, she lived until 107, but it's the fact that now, you know, she survived by her son and great grandchildren, great grandchildren. That's also what survived.
There's a legacy there to carry on.
A new generation.
Because of her and what she did.
Yeah. So that's the kind of the quick version of Mimi Reinhart, and her work with Oscar Schindler. So yeah, if you want to read the article, I'll put up these and everything else we'll refer to, on our website, penholetalkradio.ca. All the articles and sources are always listed up there for you to check out, all, including from all our past episodes. Now from Mimi Reinhart's experience, we can segue into a recent development here in Canada. Last week on the episode, or on the podcast, we referenced and talked about a little bit about the budget, the federal budget that was just announced. And part of that budget, though, is the inclusion of a change to the criminal code.
Government bills and stuff, they always like to group things together that make no sense, but
yeah,
not uncommon.
It's not, but yeah, it's just another way that government could be cleaned up a little bit. I think instead of all these grouped bills with unconnected ideas and amendments to them.
Yeah.
But anyways, that's not the issue this time, at least. What is included in the budget bill, though, is a change to the criminal code. And what's going to happen is that Holocaust denial is now going to be outlawed in Canada. So the headline from CTV News again says Holocaust denial and downplaying the Nazis' murder of Jews to be outlawed in Canada.
It sounds good. It's really, like, I don't think there's any denying that. I would hope everyone, or very close to everyone, thinks it's a bad idea to deny the Holocaust. It's a bad thing to deny the Holocaust.
Yeah.
To minimize,
both factually and morally.
Yes.
But yes.
So to minimize the atrocities of the Nazis is not good. Morally, generally not good. And it's not something we should be encouraging. But there seems to be an issue here.
Yeah. All right. So the article goes on by saying Holocaust denial is to be outlawed in Canada in a further effort to stamp out rising anti-Semitism. The federal government is set to make it a criminal offense to make a statement denying the Holocaust took place, or condoning or downplaying the killing of Jews by the Nazi regime, except in a private conversation. And then later on, it also mentions that even though the criminal code is changing, I don't believe there's any note yet of what the punishment would be for this crime.
Right.
Now, this inclusion into the budget bill is actually kind of basically taking a private bill that was already going through the process, or through the legislature at the moment, and just kind of including it into the government, or into the budget bill. It says that the government move to change the law follows the introduction by Saskatoon Tory MP Kevin Waugh of a private member's bill prohibiting Holocaust denial earlier this year. And so that was already in second reading. And so there's already something in the works. So they're already just kind of adding to it. Now, in in the conservatives bill or this private members bill by Kevin Waugh, they had mentioned 2 years, I believe, a 2 year punishment. Yep. Punishment or proposed up to 2 years in prison for, denying the Holocaust. So, but officially that's not in the budget bill. So we'll have to wait and see where that lands. Now, this isn't strange as far as outlining this. In fact, it says Canada will join a string of European countries, including Germany, Greece, France, Belgium, and the Czech Republic, which have already prohibited Holocaust denial. And then it goes on to say that 6 million Jews were systematically killed in Nazi-occupied Europe while Hitler was in power, along with other groups such as Roma. And so, yeah, like you said, like, it seems like this is a good idea, at least as far as it goes on an individual basis. Like, I don't know how you can deny the Holocaust without it being motivated by some sort of anti-Semitism.
Yeah, unless you are just completely mistaken on history.
Yeah,
you have to be pretty
hard-pressed.
You'd have to be pretty poorly educated, falsely educated to not know what happened, to not have any understanding of what happened.
Yeah.
So, yeah, you would think that really to deny the Holocaust publicly, like this is saying it's in a private conversation, it's not illegal. So this is obviously to publicly promote or deny that the Holocaust happened.
Yeah, so that's an important caveat.
Yeah, having that caveat in there, it does make it pretty clear that the likely intent is to promote anti-Semitism.
Yeah.
If you're going out there to say this publicly, what's your motivation other than something like anti-Semitism?
It'd be hard, malicious. Nothing certainly comes to mind. And yeah, those things just go together now. And so, yeah, this is one of those tricky ones with government where I think it's doing good, but I'm not sure this is the forum or it shouldn't be under their purview to affect this change. Remember, we've talked about this all the time, about these different institutes, these different spheres, realms of authority, where, you know, you have your business, you have, you know, your commerce, you have your church has authority. We have authority relationships in the family, parents and children. We have authority structures even within marriage. And each of those are designed to do certain goods.
Yeah.
And usually to do certain goods, to fulfill certain purposes that those other authority structures aren't suited to do.
Yeah.
I wonder if this doesn't fit into that kind of category where government is doing a good that should be more accomplished at the individual level, at the family level, within churches. Like the church, as far as I'm concerned, the church has a certain moral authority. So like this is something where, like, if this was really a societal issue, the church should be like front and center speaking up against this kind of stuff.
Right.
But yeah, this... The government getting involved here, it makes me, especially when I question kind of the moral guidance of this government already. Does this set us in a direction or a path that it feels like it can continue down to other avenues?
Yeah, this specific scenario, I think most people can agree that this is not a bad direction to go, or not a bad thing to put in place. It's the precedent that it sets for where it could go.
Mm-hmm.
It, like, to deny the Holocaust, I think generally everybody agrees is a bad thing. But then where does it lead if they're setting a precedent of the government banning you from public presentation of ideas?
Yeah, right. Like what other ideas get grouped into that? Like, so... What is the limiting principle behind this bill then? Like, why does the Holocaust get special recognition that would then therefore exclude say denying the Rwandan genocide or residential school perspective.
Yeah.
Like that here has been called a cultural genocide. And I honestly have it's really easy to imagine this government sometime in the not too distant future taking a very similar approach to this, where you can't come out and have a certain perspective on residential schools.
Yeah.
Like we can debate the factual, we can debate the factual or the moral positioning of, say, Holocaust denial. That's one thing.
Yeah.
What we're talking about though is whether or not the government has a say or the rightful authority to step in here and say, no, you citizen, you cannot promote this, or you cannot advocate this view. Yeah. There has to be some strong principles that kind of hem that power in. It's hard. I don't know what it is in this case though. And like I said, I question the moral guidance of that the current government is kind of following.
Heard the argument about it being verifiable history, but even that these days doesn't seem to be terribly consistent.
Yeah.
Because to say it as a ban on denying verifiable history, so in this case the Holocaust is the specific example, but you could use that to apply to any of these genocides throughout history or any atrocities that have happened. If it's a verifiable event and you're denying it, I can kind of see how that could be the limiting principle here.
Maybe. Yeah. Like that's at least a good attempt. I'll give it that. It's a good attempt. It ends up being kind of just history by majority kind of approach to things. And so I don't know why, you know, Even if that was the case, you know, why does the majority get to determine my view of history or what I can advocate is history? The Holocaust is so overwhelmingly confirmed and accepted as historical fact. Like you can go to Auschwitz right now,
yeah,
and walk into the gas chambers and see what it was. Like,
yeah,
it's there. And so I would take more of this approach of this kind of, I guess what might be considered this kind of more libertarian or libertarian approach to these kind of ideas. Get all the ideas out on the table and let's discuss these. And over time, I would hopefully think that the good ideas and those supporting those good ideas will overwhelm those
yeah.
who would propose factually and morally incorrect positions. Now, obviously that doesn't happen overnight. and though in this case, you know, how many Holocaust deniers are out there, especially in any kind of prominence in with any kind of audience? Like this is just anti-Semitism is out there. This is true.
Yes.
In fact, another quote from that article, says that, there's a disproportionate here. It says, this is quoting from Richard Marceau. He's the vice president of the Center for Israel and Jewish Affairs. And he says that Jewish Canadians comprise 1% of the Canadian population, yet are the target of 62% of all religiously motivated hate crimes. And so he says, we are living in a time of rising anti-Semitism. I'll take him at his word for this. This is certainly... This like I said, anti-Semitism is out there, and it needs to be confronted. I don't know how much further does this push any anti-Semitism back into the shadows, as it were.
Yeah.
Like people who are committing these kind of crimes, these anti-Semitic crimes, aren't going to go, oh shoot, you've banned the Holocaust denial, I guess I can't be anti-Semitic anymore.
Yeah.
It's not going to happen. That's not how it works. And I guess that kind of leads to kind of another thought I had about this is that so many laws seem to be set up to in some way, eliminate evil. Now, I think law and a good justice system, and really this is what government is set up to do, or is kind of given the authority to do, is to restrain and limit evil.
Yeah.
Now though, I think oftentimes we get confused with that kind of restraint of evil by thinking we can just eliminate it altogether. If we just put enough good laws on the books, we'll eliminate evil from the heart of every human kind of idea. And so government becomes this kind of savior that we need. And the only problem is that we don't have the right laws, or we don't have the right government in place to enact and enforce right. the right laws. So it becomes this kind of savior complex, or the savior view of government when these right. laws are put in place. Like I said, I don't think this is really going to change a lot of attitude. If people are anti-Semitic, this law is not going to change your view.
Yeah, I really don't think that many people that are, like, I think you kind of said that, is the number of people that are committing these crimes that are anti-Semitic, how many of them are actually denying the Holocaust? Probably none of them.
No.
Or very, very few.
Yeah.
And so it's, how is this going to change anything?
Yeah, I don't know if it's going to bring down that stat, like that 62% of all religiously motivated hate crimes are aimed at Jewish Canadians. I don't see how that's going to affect that number, because yeah, that anti-Semitism is rooted in the human heart, like that, and it's not going to be extracted out of it by the law. So that's what I mean. So what we need is to confront those ideas with better ideas, and ultimately, as we're talking about Easter, with a saving. No, or saving grace of the gospel, like that's what's going to change human hearts. And so though this law might have, you know, good intentions, I just question the government's authority or the reach of the government into this realm. And whether or not this is just another example of kind of government overreach, government playing the savior kind of role. I think this is more an action that should be accomplished and confronted on more of an individual family church end of things in those realms of authority. This is where these kind of things need to be confronted, especially when there isn't clear limits on why the government wouldn't extend this to other points of view.
Yeah.
All right, so we've looked at life. We've looked at some topics on death. Now let's kind of wrap up with another article on life after death, or at least some version of it. Yeah, go ahead.
The ability to live forever in now, some unusual sense of the term live.
No, there's something, and perhaps we'll flesh that out a little bit as we go, but there... This kind of next story, I think it resonates with people. It resonates with this sense of eternity that we have. I think C.S. Lewis had something, I think some line about that, about kind of eternity rests in the heart of every human or something like that.
Yeah.
He said, if it's him, he said it much better than I did. But but there's this sense that there's something past these four score years that we get.
Yeah.
And so... this next story comes from Vice, and it's with the headline, Metaverse Company to Offer Immortality Through, quote, Live Forever Mode. And then the kind of the subtitle is, Somnium Space is developing a way for people to talk to their loved ones even after they die. All it requires is massive amounts of personal data.
I can't help but tie this back to a show on Amazon Prime, Upload.
Yes.
The whole premise of that show is the idea that before you die, you get your consciousness uploaded to this virtual world where mm-hmm. you can live on. This, however, obviously I don't think it's trying to push to the point of consciousness so much as creating like an AI version of yourself.
Yeah.
So this is more for those who live on without you rather than you living on in the metaverse, but it's
there no doubt there are some that will see this as literally living forever, like depending on how on your view of what it makes or what it is to be human or a person. if all it means is to transfer, like if all you are just a complex arrangement of electrical signals, well, you can just replace all that with ones and zeros and upload them somewhere.
Yeah, if it's all about input output, we can do that in the metaverse.
Yeah,
we can have just, input and output.
We just need bigger computers and a little bit smarter AI, perhaps. Like, but for depending on your view of humans, this is eternal life in a way.
Yeah.
But the article starts by talking about Arthur Sykov and how his father was diagnosed with a cancer and that ultimately a terminal cancer that eventually claimed his life in a few years. And so this got him thinking about how his own children were just a few years old, and it says it pained him to think that they might grow up without a memory of their grandfather. And it says, in those moments, he started to wonder if there was some way in which their children might be able to have a conversation with their grandfather even after he was gone. And so Sykov is now the CEO and founder of Somnium Space, one of the many versions of the metaverse that have sprouted up in recent years. So basically, this is just a virtual reality world.
Yeah.
That's basically what it is.
We've been hearing a lot since Facebook has started up the whole Meta thing, yep. But this has been going on for quite a while in various forms where you can have this virtual world. And so it keeps getting referred to as the metaverse. It's just a virtual world where you can go and you can just kind of live in this world. There's always activities and things being added by various developers, but it's really just a virtual version of life.
Yeah, I think Sims, but on just an advanced scale. Like,
yeah.
It's just you are inside the Sims world.
Yeah.
And every other person you see around there is just another actual person.
Yeah.
Usually with some VR. But the difference with this, it's a VR set that they're kind of plugged into it. The difference here, though, is they want to make a virtual reality version of you or your past relatives.
Yeah, so it's not you in a VR headset or a VR environment, it's an AI copy of you.
Yes.
So it's you, a whole pile of data compiled of everything about you, every way you interact, your mannerisms, to create you run by a computer.
Yes. the article says that the death of Sykov's father served as the inspiration for an idea that he would come to call live forever mode, a forthcoming feature in Somnium Space that allows people to have their movements and conversations stored as data, then duplicated as an avatar that moves, talks, and sounds just like you and can continue to do so long after you've died. In Sykov's dream, people who will be able to talk to their dead loved one whenever they wish. So, like I said, this is a virtual you. So basically this is their view of humanity. If we just get to know enough information about you, we can make a digital replica of you.
Yeah.
And and you wouldn't know the difference when you're talking to them. In fact, this isn't just replaying old. This is far different than just looking at old videotapes. Like, this is creating you in the virtual world that can interact with you in the real world, so to speak. This is quite something. In fact, later on in the article, it talks about, so there's one thing to kind of look at. Even now, we can kind of make it look like, There's technology out there called deepfake technology where you can make someone look like you can take someone's face and kind of virtually transpose that onto someone else's.
Yeah.
Now I just watched a recent YouTube video from Quarter Crew. If you haven't, they're worth a shout out. They have some fun videos on kind of this technology, virtual effects, that kind of thing, or video effects. And there's a service out there that can in real time change your voice into someone else's. Like, so I could be talking to you and this would automatically transform it into a British female voice in real time. And so they had some fun with that. But this even goes even further than that. So it's not just to make you look like the virtual you, not just to make you sound like it, but here it says he says he wants to make it look where you can actually move like you. So yeah, I think we all know this, like you can tell who's coming down the stairs or up the stairs just by listening to the footsteps.
Yeah, the
right?
way they move, the way they walk, and everything it's, about the yeah, way right? they carry themselves, you'll recognize that person.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's how you can recognize somebody from behind so easily, is their gait, the way they walk is unique.
Yep. And so they're going to transport that into this software as well. It says, one October 2020 study published in Nature, for example, concluded that after less than 5 minutes of tracking people's body motions, virtual reality technology could identify someone with 95% accuracy out of a group of 500. So it gets 5 minutes. It's a computer that spends 5 minutes analyzing you, how you walk, how you move. And then it sounds like they put you into a group of 500 and it can pick you out just by your movements.
Yeah. Well, and you think now how much data is available on everyone, especially with social media. It would not take that much with technology like this. It wouldn't take that much of scanning through people's photos and people's videos and all the data that we've got on everybody. You go through one person's Facebook feed and something like this would be able to pick up every mannerism, every way they talk, every word they use regularly. And you'd be able to create an AI version that would be very convincing.
Yeah. 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 I'm all of a sudden feeling very nervous about this podcast.
we're sitting here filming ourselves.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Cause the article goes on to mention how, they'll collect all this data now, but then as technology advances over time, they'll be able to utilize that data in more and more advanced ways. And so you're basically upgrading your virtual self as technology advances.
Yeah.
It goes on to talk about how Somnium Space is partnering with this other company to build a full body haptic suit for VR.
This has been the dream of VR people for a very long time. This idea that you can have a suit that you feel physical interactions in the virtual world.
Yeah, because right now, basically VR is limited to your goggles, and so you can look around in kind of this virtual space. And I've seen some prototypes of like haptic gloves.
Yeah, there's a guy that's doing this on his own just for a fun project during COVID. He's been developing these gloves that have motors attached to all the fingers. And so when you move, you can move each individual finger in VR, but it also has resistance built into them. So you can feel like you're grabbing an object. Like you will feel like you are grabbing it because the motors stop your fingers.
Yeah. It's pulling back on your fingers.
Yeah. And so we've gotten to that point in VR where you can actually have interaction with your hands, but this is talking about doing it for your body. You could feel a hug with this person, like you interacting with this dead relative. You could go up and give them a hug.
Yes.
Feel like you are hugging this person.
Yeah. So you mentioned this TV show, or series, Upload, that's on Amazon Prime. And this is part of it, is that they have these full body suits. So your friend, relative, husband, whatever has died, their consciousness has been uploaded to this virtual world, and you can don these full body suits and basically transport yourself into that environment.
It sounds so insane, but this is the reality we're living in.
Yeah, now
the technology is finally getting there where companies are actually pursuing it.
Yeah.
This isn't science fiction anymore. This is becoming reality.
Yeah. Another website or another YouTube channel to check out is Smarter Every Day.
Yes.
And he has a video. It's from probably a year or so ago by now, but it's on this company that's building these haptic gloves. And it's really interesting because, you know, he's in this kind of virtual environment and his little fox creature jumps on your virtual hand, and yet you actually feel his feet walking across your hand because your hand is inside this glove that's reacting to this virtual thing, giving you real sensations.
Yeah.
Like, we're not far off from the Matrix here. Like, this is the only difference between where we are with the now versus the Matrix is that right now we still have to input signals into our brain through our skin and our body. But how much further does it go? We're just going to input that into our brains.
They're already doing that to some extent too. There's already companies looking at brain implants that allow impulses that will feel like sensations and stuff like that. So
yeah, I know when they do brain surgery, and oftentimes they'll have to keep the patient conscious.
Yeah.
Because they have to know, okay, what do you feel when I touch this part of your brain?
Yeah.
I can't taste anything now. I can't smell anything.
I've seen those videos where you have, like, there was some famous violinist going through brain surgery, and they had them play the violin while performing the surgery to know that they're not
in the wrong
interacting
area.
In the wrong part of the brain.
Right. Yeah. And so this is what's going on. Like, we're getting into some very heavy waters here. I think morally, as we go forward. So yeah, this full body suit, it says the suit will not only allow those wearing it to receive electrical signals comparable to human touch, but also provide extra data thanks to the inclusion of a medical grade biometric scanner that collects cardio and stress levels.
So if you didn't think Facebook collected enough information on you, this company will be able to scan every breath you're taking, every heartbeat while you're in this virtual world.
They're in the process of setting this up, and really the technology is there. Like, this is not that futuristic.
Yeah.
I think all the pieces are there. There's some things that might just have to be tuned up a little bit, but in actuality, like, this is achievable this right now.
Yeah. So it really brings up that question of, well, I guess it brings up one question of why are we pursuing something like this idea of live forever mode?
I think it appeals to a lot of people. But yeah. Then the question is, like, why? Now you start getting into, like, kind of these existential questions of humanity that humans have wrestled with throughout their existence. Yeah. Like, you know, part of this is, you know, this avoidance of suffering, I think is part of it. And perhaps in another episode, we'll have to talk about, kind of different changes that are going on with medical assistance and dying. And that, how that plays into this, but this is part of it here too, is this struggle to let go of our loved ones. And with this, and that's what I mean. That's how he starts out the whole article, is like, my kids won't be able to have a memory of their grandfather. And so I'll just recreate a virtual grandpa.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so there's this, avoiding of loss, of suffering, and you know, maybe there's something true about that. You know, there's something about us that doesn't, we weren't made, I don't think, to suffer. That is part of this corrupted, fallen world. So I think there's something good about longing to get rid of suffering.
Yeah.
But at the same time, you know, I think there's things that can be learned through suffering that can't be learned otherwise as well. And, you know, maybe we miss out on that if we just think of suffering as this ultimate evil or just something that is no good can come from. There's that component. The other thought was that this is kind of really creating kind of a humanistic heaven.
Yeah, I think that something like this is going to be far, far more popular among those who don't have a belief or a concept of the afterlife.
How certain are you of the afterlife, right? Kind of approach.
Because if you're convinced if you truly believe that there is a heaven and this person that has died that you have lost in this life is in that better place and you will one day be with them, you're going to be less incentivized to hold on to them, to feel like you need to keep some version of them here.
Yeah.
There's a lot more optimistic outlook, but without that, this is a way of creating that version of heaven.
Yeah. This certainly would, I don't know. Yeah. I think you're right. It would probably appeal to those that don't have any kind of acceptance or belief that there is an afterlife. Though even for believers who have a concept of heaven, you know, who really wants to say goodbye? Like it's still painful, you know, even if you think you're going to see your loved one, you know, even in a few years from now, you know, and you'll spend eternity with them. Why go through that 50 years that they're absent?
Yeah.
You can create a virtual one of them.
I fear this would do for somebody's coping and moving on with loss. I worry obviously for some people it'd be fine, but you would see those who are going to get so caught up in the emotion of it, in the grief, that this will become their reality.
Yeah.
When you lose that person and the only way you can be with them is in this virtual world, they're going to get lost in that.
Yeah, there's it's perhaps not as popular now, but you know, you used to have infomercials galore about, you know, psychics and seances, and, you know, hearing from the dead. Like there's even TV shows, and like you had the whole Jonathan Edwards thing, I think that was his name. He had whole TV shows where he would kind of act as this kind of seance, as this kind of medium in between. This is kind of the newfangled seance here. This is how you quote resurrect your dead, is in this kind of virtual space. And yeah, there's, I think, and then it becomes this faux reality.
Yeah.
And yeah, I think that's where you can get kind of disconnected from what is actually real. I'm sure that there's a sci-fi reality or a sci-fi movie or episode that's in my mind. I just can't remember what it is. I'm sure that's already been made. Yeah. And then I guess the other thought as well is that this does have this kind of reductionistic view of humanity, where all we are our physical beings, or just, you know, or electrical signals in our brain. Like how much, it's not much of a step to say that this is, we have so much data on you that we can create a virtual version of you that is, that's not distinguishable from the real you, quote unquote.
Yeah.
At what point then this is what gets into the whole transhumanism kind of thing, where we go beyond humanity.
Yeah.
And basically end up kind of creating a new class or a new race of humans. It sounds so sci-fi, but you can see it's not far down this road that we're looking, that this kind of stuff takes place, especially if you take this kind of physicalistic materials view of what a human is. If you can, like with all these full body sensory suits going on, if it's so good, you can imagine just living in that suit forever and not even knowing it.
Yeah.
And that's basically what the Matrix is when you're talking about the movie. Like, you don't know the difference.
Yeah.
Yeah. Even in that movie, there's a difference. There's a breaking out of that virtual world into the real world that they see as good in those movies.
Yeah. Even the struggle of fighting the machines in the real world is still something to strive for, even if you could have just gone back into that virtual world and
virtual ideal heaven-like world.
Not knowing the difference.
Yeah. Wow. there are certainly some interesting technological times ahead for so much of this stuff.
And yeah, we're getting to that stage where the technology is bringing up a lot of ethical questions. We're getting into a realm where we can create such reality, such a true virtual reality, realities that really do have some significant substance to them as a virtual environment, that it starts bringing up ethical questions of what should we be doing? Mm-hmm. Is this something that we should pursue?
Yeah, to draw from the wisdom of Jeff Goldblum, we didn't stop to ask ourselves if we should be doing this.
Yeah. Yep.
Interesting. Just at the very end of this article, you know, they have all their little tags, you know, of how they sort these articles, and they have things like VR, virtual reality, immortality, and they even tag it as God. And I know that's kind of an interesting way to kind of close out this episode. You know, this is branded as a live forever mode. And I hope you can forgive me, though I'm not really asking for your forgiveness. This Easter, like, there is a truly real live forever mode.
No haptic suit required, no upload of all your data.
No, yeah, and it's really you. It's not virtual you, it's not a duplicate you. It's a real you. And in fact, it's actually been alpha tested, I guess. I'm not sure. What's the threshold for alpha and beta? It's been tried and proven true.
Yeah.
About 2000 years ago, that this whole live forever mode, and the defeat of death, this avoidance of suffering, it's been accomplished, and it's available for everyone. Through the cross and through the death and resurrection of Jesus Christ. And the best part is in the movie Upload, or in the TV series Upload, it's funny because all it is, it's the same world. Like, it has all the same problems. Like, yeah. You're still suffering. There's still, immorality going on. There's still all these, especially in this TV show, as you go through it, there's interactions between the real world and the suffering and the evilness of the real world that's infecting into the virtual world. It's not the heaven I want.
Yeah, it's not a heaven by any stretch of the imagination.
Yeah, all you're doing is living in a kind of a new virtual world. It all looks real to you. So what real difference is it if your live forever mode is still has all that suffering and evil and immorality packed into it? I don't want that one. You can, I'll save my subscription costs and not charge for that one. I think there's a better live forever mode out there. And it's available to everyone through the life and death of Jesus Christ. So mm-hmm. Please look into that. That is the far better deal than this one. Than any worldly version of heaven. So there is probably one interesting Easter episode of a podcast you've ever come across. But yes, we've traveled through life. We've traveled through death. We've hit the life after death. And now we have to close out the show. All these articles that we've talked about and all these other references that we've gone through, if I can remember them, I'll try to put the links up onto our website, penholetalkradio.ca. But if not, just rewatch the episode and take notes, I guess. But thank you for coming along with us through this interesting journey through these different articles. My name is Brian Constein.
And I'm Michael Rowland.
And this has been Penhole Talk Radio.